need courts. We need the Constitution. We need laws. They remind us of our commitments to our better selves. But it recognizes a central truth, which is that ultimately, the guardians of liberty are not the courts, they're us. They are citizens. They are you and me. They are every one of us. We can be guardians of liberty, and if we are, liberty will flourish. And if we don't, it won't. We can't rely on courts, constitution, and law. We have to engage ourselves.
That's David Cole, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features David Cole on Guardians of Liberty. The wheels of justice turn slowly. How long before Jim Crow laws were overturned? How long for the Supreme Court to recognize gay marriage equality? How long the wait times in immigration courts? And even when someone or some cause has their proverbial day in court, the courts have an uneven record in dispensing justice. The legal field recognizes the power exerted by major court decisions. But civil rights organizations, like the American Civil Liberties Union and others, point to the need for groundswells of civic groups to take bold and principled stands. An aroused and informed citizenry are the guardians of liberty. Our guest today is David Cole. He's the National Legal Director of the American Civil Liberties Union. Before joining the ACLU, he taught law at Georgetown University Law Center. He's the author of a number of books, including Engines of Liberty. He spoke at Colorado College in Colorado Springs in September 2019. And now, David Cole.
My topic for today is defending liberty in times of peril. It's kind of an academic topic. No, it isn't. In some respects, it's something that the ACLU has been doing for its entire existence. The ACLU is in its 100th year, and it has fought for liberty in times of peril at many junctures in this country's history. In World War I and the outgrowth of World War I, which involved the targeting of anarchists and communists and progressives and involved the jailing of people for merely criticizing the war. World War II, which involved the internment of 110,000 Japanese people in the United States simply because they were of Japanese ancestry, 70,000 of them U.S. citizens. To the struggle against Jim Crow laws in the South and the effort to end segregation first in law and then in practice. To the defense of civil rights activists during that period and peace activists during the Vietnam War period. To fighting back against President George W. Bush when he responded to the attacks on this country on 9/11 by authorizing torture and rendition and indefinite detention of enemy combatants without trial, without charges, and mass surveillance. To today's challenge in responding to Trump. All of these are times of peril for civil liberties. And the traditional story, I think, is that courts are there to protect us in times of peril. Courts are designed to be counter-majoritarian. They don't have to run for re-election, and therefore they have the ability to stand up for the principles that are often thrown by the wayside in times of crisis. And so courts have protected the rights of speakers, whether they be civil rights protesters or anti-war protesters or the like. It's protected the right to associate with political groups, and in particular, out of the McCarthy era, the protection ultimately of those who supported or were affiliated with the Communist Party. The courts have defended and advanced equality, equality for African Americans, equality for women, equality for LGBT folks. Courts extended habeas corpus rights to the foreign nationals held at Guantanamo as enemy combatants. So that's sort of the traditional story, right? Courts are there to be the backstop in these times of peril. But the real story is a lot more complicated than that. The real story is that courts ultimately protected speech, ultimately protected the right of association, but only sort of near the end of the times of peril for communists. It was after the after Joe McCarthy had been censored by the Senate, after the country sort of had abandoned him, that the court finally came up with a principle that protects against guilt by association. At the height of the McCarthy era, the courts were pretty willing to allow the government to target and penalize people simply for their affiliation with the Communist Party. And of course, the courts upheld the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II and upheld separate but equal for a 60-year period in this country until in Brown versus Board of Education, the court overturned that decision. So reliance on courts is not sufficient in times of peril. I will argue it's not sufficient in times of non-peril. Courts are part of the story, but they're not by any means all of the story. So I want to talk mostly about how we at the ACLU have sought to defend liberty in this time of peril and illustrate how it is an effort that requires the involvement of people in all walks of life, involved in advocacy in a whole wide range of forums outside of the courts, as well as litigation in the courts. But before I get there, I want to tell two stories about constitutional change to illustrate the point that civil liberties and civil rights are as dependent upon democracy as they are on courts and litigation. And so the first story, and these are both of these stories are in my book, Engines of Liberty, which I wrote the year before I started working for the ACLU. It is about how people work to achieve change, in particular constitutional change. And in some respects, constitutional change is the hardest kind of change to make because it's resistant to ordinary democratic processes. So if you can make constitutional change, well, that is a pretty good lesson for how you can make change in other areas. And so to tell that story, I looked at a few sort of case studies of what I think are fairly successful stories of change in the last 30 years. I'll tell two of them here. One you'll like, one some of you may not like. The first is marriage equality. The second is gun rights. So, and I talk about both in the book, not because I'm in favor of marriage equality and gun rights. You can guess which I'm in favor of. But because both are stories of successful advocacy for change and constitutional change. So marriage equality. How did marriage equality go from being unthinkable in the 1980s, even the 1990s, to a constitutional right in 2015? And gun rights, and in particular the individual right to bear arms, how did it go from 1990, when Warren Berger, a conservative Republican former Supreme Court justice, said about the notion that the Constitution protects an individual right to bear arms? He said that was one of the greatest frauds perpetrated on the American people in his lifetime. How did it go from being one of the greatest frauds perpetrated on the American people in his lifetime, rejected by the courts for 100 years. Courts for 100 years said the Second Amendment doesn't protect an individual right to bear arms. It protects the right of states to have militias as a check on federal overreaching, but it doesn't protect the rights of individuals to have guns free of regulation by the state. How did that right go from a fraud in 1990 to a constitutional right in 2008? And the stories are actually remarkably similar because they're stories about organizations of people, associations of people who care about a particular value, a particular norm, come together and work through civil society to advance that vision. And so marriage equality, I begin with telling the story of Evan Wolfson, who as a young Harvard Law student in 1984 decided that he wanted to write a paper about the right of same-sex couples to marry. And he went to all the constitutional law professors at Harvard Law School and said, "Will you, you know, supervise me in writing this paper?" And every one of them turned him down. The idea was so outlandish, so frivolous, so crazy that no constitutional law professor would even supervise the paper. He finally found a trusts and estates professor to agree to supervise the paper. He didn't know anything about constitutional law, but he was a nice guy. He supervised the paper. Evan wrote a 144-page paper. I don't know how long your, senior theses are, but 140, and this was before word processing. I've seen it. It's like typed out, you know, on an old-fashioned typewriter. 144 pages. He got a B+ for the paper, which I'm told at Harvard is the lowest grade you can get for a thesis. But he didn't just stop there. He went on to become a lawyer for Lambda Legal Defense, one of the premier LGBT rights groups in this country, to persuade many within the LGBT rights movement that fighting for marriage equality was an important part of the struggle. He ultimately left Lambda and created an organization called Freedom to Marry, multi-million-dollar organization devoted to one issue, the freedom to marry, never filed a single lawsuit. Did all of its work outside of the courts. If you think about how the courts responded to marriage equality, think of two moments. The first is 1972. An ACLU lawyer in Minnesota is approached by a gay couple who say, "We think we have the right to marry." And Minnesota law doesn't specify that, you know, that the partners to the marriage have to be of opposite sexes, so we think we have the right to marry. Will you represent us? And he said, sure. And he took the case all the way up to the Supreme Court of Minnesota. And he made two arguments. Right of privacy protects the right of a couple to choose to live together and to commit to each other for life. And equal protection says that people of the same sex should have the same right as people of opposite sexes to make this kind of decision. Those were his arguments. The Minnesota Supreme Court was so underwhelmed by his argument that they didn't ask a single question while he was at the podium. One of the justices was so outraged by the fact that he would even make these arguments that he turned his back on the lawyer for the gay couple for the entirety of the argument. Shortly thereafter, the court issued its decision, saying, of course there's no right of same-sex couples to marry. See Genesis, the book of Genesis. Not usually an authoritative source in constitutional law, but that's what they cited. The ACLU lawyer then went to the Supreme Court, said to the United States Supreme Court, said, this is outrageous. This is an incorrect, erroneous interpretation of federal constitutional law. The U.S. Supreme Court dismissed the petition with a single sentence. Does not present a substantial federal question. So that was 1972. Fast forward to 2015, Obergefell versus Hodges. The Supreme Court recognizes marriage equality. in a decision written by Justice Kennedy. What are the grounds for the holding? Privacy and equal protection. So the legal arguments didn't change. It wasn't like some clever lawyer, you know, came up with a new argument. These were the same arguments that were made in 1972, the same arguments that Evan Wolfson made in his 1984 paper, the same arguments ultimately made in the Supreme Court. So the arguments didn't change. The court changed. But if anything, the court in 2015 was more conservative than the court in 1972, which was the tail end of the Warren Court, the most liberal court in history. So the court, you can't explain it by the court changing. You can't explain it by the arguments changing. What happened? The world changed. The world changed, and because the world changed, arguments that were seen as frivolous at time one were seen as inevitable at time two. And how did the world change? It didn't just change. It didn't just, like, you know, change like the seasons. It changed because people like Evan Wolfson got together in groups like Lambda Legal and Freedom to Marry and worked their butts off for many years, engaging in an incremental, carefully calibrated strategy of change. And what do I mean by that? Well, they didn't, you know, once that 1972 decision came down, they realized they're not going to get this out of the United States Supreme Court. So there's no point in continuing to make federal constitutional arguments that you have a right to marry because you're just going to lose. It doesn't even present a substantial federal question. So that forum is closed off. So you look for other forums. And one of the great things about the United States is we have 50 forums, 51. We have the federal forum, national government, federal courts. That's one body of law. But every state has its own law, has its own constitution. And so they started at the state level. And indeed, in some places, they started at the local level because states have laws, but so do cities have laws. And so they started seeking to make small changes in a variety of different kinds of laws that all were to the point of normalizing the fact that two people of the same sex choose to commit to each other. So they did things like changing family law to recognize the right of two same-sex parents to adopt a child together. They did things like getting non-discrimination ordinances enacted in progressive cities and towns. They did things like getting domestic partnership benefits that employers provide extended to same-sex partners as well as married partners. And they started with liberal colleges and universities and a few progressive corporations, and then they went to the progressive cities like Berkeley and Santa Monica and Cambridge and places like that. But they continually expanded the scope of these rights to the point where many states provided domestic partnership benefits, many states protected against hate crimes based on sexual orientation, many states prohibited discrimination in employment on the basis of sexual orientation. Many states adopted family law provisions that were respectful of the choice of two same-sex people to live together and raise children together. And at that point, it becomes a lot smaller of a step to say people should have the right to marry. If they already have all these other rights, what's the big deal about giving them the right to marry? But still, they didn't go to federal court and argue there's a federal constitutional right to marriage because they still thought they weren't ready. They went to state courts, and they chose their states wisely. They started in Vermont, the most progressive state in the country, probably, the home of Bernie Sanders, right? And And they made an argument based only on Vermont's state constitution. And why did they do that? Why did they could make an argument based on the state constitution and the federal constitution in the same case. But they didn't. They kept the federal constitutional argument out of it. Why? Because if you make a federal constitutional argument and a state court rules for you, the Supreme Court can overturn it. But if you make a state constitutional argument that Vermont's constitution protects marriage equality, and the Vermont Supreme Court says that it does, the U.S. Supreme Court can't review that because Vermont's Supreme Court has the final word on what Vermont law is, not the U.S. Supreme Court. And they didn't get marriage in Vermont, but they got civil unions. It was a step, another incremental step. And then they defended that in Vermont from an effort to overturn it in the legislature. But then they went to Massachusetts, where they got the first decision recognizing marriage equality. Then they went to Connecticut, then to California, went to Iowa, went to the state legislature in New York, the DC City Council, and got a whole range of states to recognize marriage equality before going to the Supreme Court. And that was done by concerted efforts of people coming together around a principle that gay and lesbian folks have the same rights and same dignity as heterosexual and straight folks have. And ultimately, that position was inevitable because of the work they'd done outside the court. So the court didn't make that change. It recognized a change that had happened. And the story with gun rights is actually remarkably similar. The NRA saw that for 100 years the court had said there's no right to bear arms, that Warren Burger, a conservative Republican, had said it was a fraud, the very idea was a fraud. And so they did not go to the U.S. Supreme Court and argue that there's a constitutional right to bear arms. They went to the states, and they worked incrementally, and they chose their states wisely. They tended to start in Florida, which before Parkland was known as the Gunshine State because it was so supportive of gun rights laws. That's where the first Stand Your Ground laws were enacted, the first right to carry laws were enacted. And they would enact them in Florida, then they'd take that as an example and get it enacted in Alabama. Then they'd take that and use it in a state court challenge in Mississippi and get it recognized there. And ultimately, by the time the question got to the Supreme Court as to whether the federal constitution recognized an individual right to bear arms, they had gotten 49 of the 50 states to recognize a right to bear arms under their state laws or constitutions. A lot less of a big step for the Supreme Court to say the federal constitution does what the states already do. But they didn't only get the states, they also got academics. They created all sorts of funds for conferences to look into the history of the Second Amendment and ultimately developed a whole set of arguments that, in fact, the Second Amendment properly understood did reflect an understanding of individual right to bear arms. And that argument, by the time it got to the Supreme Court, had been adopted by not just a bunch of right-wing, gun-loving academics, but some very mainstream constitution and even liberal constitutional law professors. And they got Congress to recognize an individual right to bear arms in the preambles of two federal statutes before the Supreme Court took on the case. And they got the Justice Department of the United States to reverse its 100-year position that there is not an individual right to bear arms, to say there was an individual right to bear arms, after George W. Bush was elected with tremendous help from the NRA, and he appointed John Ashcroft as his attorney general. John Ashcroft, a longtime member of the NRA. And so the NRA then immediately wrote to John Ashcroft, "Dear John, what do you think about the fact that the Justice Department for 100 years has said there's no individual right to bear arms?" And John wrote back and said, "Dear Wayne, I think that's outrageous, and we'll do something about that." And sure enough, the Justice Department wrote a 100-page memo, on why they were wrong for 100 years, one page for each year, on why they were wrong. And in fact, there is an individual right to bear arms. So by the time 2008 came around and the question came up before the Supreme Court, the NRA had already gotten the states on board, the academics on board, Congress on board, and the executive branch on board. And so the Supreme Court just fell into line. And how does the NRA do that? It does it through democratic engagement. It does it because it has 5 million members. It has another 15 million people who think they're members of the NRA, don't pay their dues, but think they're members of the NRA. And what the NRA folks that I talked to said was, you know, we'd love to have their dues, but we're happy to have them think they're members. Because what that means is there's 20 million people out there who will respond when we say, write to this congressperson, visit this state legislature, vote in favor of this gun rights defending legislature and against this gun control legislature. It is that power that has led to the situation we have today in this country with very, very broad gun rights. And I would say even after the Supreme Court recognized the constitutional right to bear arms in 2008 in a case called District of Columbia versus Heller, today, if you ask what is the institution that is most responsible for protecting gun rights in this country, it is not the Supreme Court. It is not the federal courts. It is not Congress. It is the NRA. Because the NRA is able to stop laws from getting enacted that clearly would not be unconstitutional. Universal background checks, for example, still hasn't been enacted, clearly be constitutional. And it's able to get laws enacted, stand your ground, that are clearly not required by the Constitution. So it's more powerful than the entities that are there to protect the rights in the formal structure of the Constitution. So how does that apply to defending liberty in times of peril? Well, I think it's very instructive in terms of how to be effective in seeking to advance or defend liberty. And what it says is, don't focus only on the courts. Look elsewhere. Use the entirety of the tools of democracy. Engage the citizenry around your issue. Change the debate, the discourse, and then the courts will come along with you. When Trump was elected, we took out full-page ads in the Washington Post and the New York Times the same week that he was elected, saying, "Dear President-elect Trump, we'll see you in court." And basically what the text of the thing said was, you know, if you put in place the kinds of things you talked about on the campaign trail that we think are unconstitutional, we'll challenge you. We'll challenge you. And we have indeed seen him in court, and I'll talk about those in a second. But we haven't only seen him in court. We have also seen him in what people, you know, in the vernacular call in the streets, through grassroots mobilization in a range of ways. And those are just as critical to, and probably in the long term, more critical to defending liberty and resisting the threats on liberty that we have seen since President Trump's election. The challenge we faced when Trump was elected was significant, because usually you think about the Constitution as protecting rights through separation of powers. The judiciary will check the political branches. Congress will check the president. The president will keep Congress in line. The states will check the federal government. Usually that's how it's supposed to work. But in the wake of President Trump's election, one party controlled the president, both houses of Congress, a majority of the Supreme Court, and two-thirds of the state legislatures. So where was the resistance going to come from in a situation like that? And I think the answer is civil society. The answer is the sort of soft form of checks and balances. Not the hard form of government structures, but the soft form of people coming together in institutions that stand for the principles that they care about. And this is protected in the First Amendment. This is why I think the First Amendment is so fundamental. Because at the end of the day, what the First Amendment protects is the right of people to resist oppression. It protects the right to speak out against oppression. It protects the right to petition the government for redress of grievances, to complain about repression. It protects the right to associate, to come together, to build institutions and organizations that are stronger than any one individual in defense of fundamental principles and in resistance to government oppression. It protects the academy, where critical thinking is supported. It protects religion, which in many countries can be a form of resistance because it involves people coming together around a set of norms that are not dictated by the government. And all of this is protected by the First Amendment. We think about the First Amendment often as an individual right. You know, the right to read what you want, to say what you want, to be who you are. And it is an individual right. But more importantly, or at least equally importantly, it's a right of resistance. It's a right of checks and balances. It is a way in which we, again, guard against government overreaching. And how do you know this? Because if you look around the world and you look what autocratic leaders do when they come to power, who do they attack? They attack the academy. They attack civil society. They attack their critics, right? They attack religion. They attack those sources, and they attack the press. I forgot the press, also protected by the First Amendment. They seek to shut down the press or control the press because they understand that those are the forms of resistance.
You're listening to David Cole on Guardians of Liberty. This is Independent Alternative Radio.
So inspiring in this time of peril is how robust American civil society is, how engaged Americans have been since November 9th, 2016. I wish they'd been a little more engaged on November 8th, 2016, but since November 9th, they have been engaged. You know, it starts with the women's movement. The largest march in American history, put together in a couple months, the largest march in American history. And then it goes to the airport demonstrations against the Muslim ban. The first thing Trump did was put the Muslim ban into effect on a Friday night, first week in office. And that weekend, tens of thousands of Americans got up off their couches, turned off the television, went out to airports to demonstrate, to protest what Trump was doing. And Trump wasn't threatening their rights. He was threatening the rights of foreign nationals, of Muslim foreign nationals. And yet, tens of thousands of Americans went out to airports to demonstrate. That, I think, is remarkable, both because they're protecting the rights of others and because they were willing to go voluntarily to an airport. You know, I don't know about you. It's the last place I want to be unless I have to go somewhere. It's a soul-crushing atmosphere. You know, even at Denver, you know, the world's greatest airport, it's not the kind of place you really want to go. But people went to protest. And then you saw the town halls to save Obamacare when Trump was repeatedly seeking, unsuccessfully, to repeal it. And then you had the Me Too movement. You know, I believe that sexual harassment has been around since Adam and Eve. But it took the election of a sexual harasser in chief to launch the Me Too movement. Parkland and the March for Our Lives. We've had one mass shooting after another. not far from here in Aurora, all in so many places in this country we've had mass shootings. And yet it was a mass shooting after Trump was elected that inspired students from across this country to launch a nationwide movement to advance gun control. And gun control is on the rise in significant part because of that student movement. Those aren't like coincidences. And if any one of those movements had come to be in a period of 2.5-3 years, people would say, well, that's pretty remarkable. But all of them, I think it's a reflection of people's understanding that when our rights are under attack, we have to engage, we have to come together, we have to work with those organizations that are fighting back. And so we've seen it at the ACLU. We went from 400,000 members, largest civil liberties, civil rights organization in the world, 400,000 members before Trump was elected, to 1.8 million members after Trump's election. Thank you. Planned Parenthood has never had more support than it has since Trump's election, because Trump has threatened to overturn Roe versus Wade, and Planned Parenthood is the premier institution fighting back. The New York Times, the Washington Post have never had higher subscription rates than they have today, because people understand this is a critical part of civil society checking government. An engaged press that reports on the abuses that the government is engaged in. And we saw it in the midterms, where there was a blue wave across the country. Democrats picked up 40 seats in the House, which is the largest net gain for that party in a single election since 1947. So there's been a tremendous upsurge of engagement around these core issues. So what have we done at the ACLU? We told the president, we'll see you in court, and we have indeed sued him over and over and over with a really strong success record. So we have challenged virtually every one, successfully challenged virtually every one of his efforts to deter people from coming to this country to apply for asylum, from separating parents from their children at the border, a kind of Sophie's Choice to discourage people from coming to this country. We challenged that policy and a court enjoined it. To a rule that would have barred people from seeking asylum if they don't come into the country legally in the first place, even though the statute that affords asylum says anyone who fears persecution at home can seek asylum, whether they came here legally or illegally. We challenged that practice, and a court enjoined it. To a practice of detaining anyone who's applying for asylum for the year or more that it takes to resolve their asylum petition, even if there's no reason to detain them. We challenged that in court successfully. To a policy that said we will deny asylum to anyone who came here through another country and was not already denied asylum in that country. That would deny asylum to anyone from Latin America, because, of course, to get to the United States, they have to come through Mexico, and they don't apply for asylum in Mexico because they're not going to get it. It's not safe, and so they come here. We challenge that as contrary to the statute, and the courts enjoined it. We challenged the transgender military ban, and the courts enjoined it. The Supreme Court stayed that injunction pending further litigation, but we're continuing to litigate it. We challenged the Muslim ban. The first Muslim ban was struck down by the courts. The second Muslim ban struck down by the courts. The third Muslim ban struck down by the lower courts, upheld, as you know, by the Supreme Court in a 5-4 very disappointing decision. But that Muslim ban, that third Muslim ban that they upheld, was still a Muslim ban, but it was a much narrower ban than the initial ones were. We challenged the revocation of DACA. The courts enjoined the revocation of DACA. That's now pending before the Supreme Court, and we decided this term. We challenged his effort to put a citizenship question on the census, which was designed to deter immigrants from responding to the census, even though the census is supposed to count all people in the country, not all citizens. And that would have led to an undercount in places with significant immigrant populations, which happened to be more Democrat than Republican. So we challenged that in court and won in the Supreme Court in June. We sued to challenge his creation of a voter integrity commission. This was a commission that he put together right after he came into office. It was designed to gin up stories of voter fraud in order to justify the tactic of voter suppression. We challenged it. Many other organizations challenged it. In fact, one of the members of the commission himself challenged the commission in court. And ultimately, Trump disbanded the commission, saying there's just too many lawsuits. We challenged the detention of a U.S. citizen as an enemy combatant in Iraq. And they ultimately were forced to release him. We challenged one of the most cruel policies the Trump administration put into place, which was a policy that denies young, undocumented women who are held in federal custody access to a clinic to get an abortion when they learn that they're pregnant and exercise their constitutional right to get an abortion. The Trump administration said, we won't let you out of the compound to go to the clinic to get your abortion. We challenged that in court, and the courts enjoined it nationwide. We challenged the erection of the fake emergency wall, and the courts enjoined that. The Supreme Court lifted part of that injunction pending appeal, and we are continuing to fight that in court. So we've been pretty successful, and the courts have actually been pretty good in standing up to the president. As I said at the outset, you can't rely solely on the courts. And as we saw with the NRA and as we saw with the marriage equality groups, if you're going to really build and defend liberty, you've got to go outside of the courts. You've got to use all the tools in your arsenal. So one of the things we did in the wake of President Trump's election and all the new members we had, 1.4 million new members, a lot of them were saying, hey, you know, we're happy to get the card saying I'm a card-carrying member of the ACLU, but we'd actually like to do something to defend liberty. And so we launched a grassroots movement. We called it People Power, which is very 1960s sounding, but it's a 21st century thing. It's facilitated by social media because that's how we get the word out to folks. But what it does is encourage people in local communities to come together as citizens to defend liberty in the local context. And we suggest campaigns for them to engage in. We take suggestions from them. We pass around best practices. And we encourage citizens to be defenders of liberty themselves. And so there have been campaigns to encourage cities to adopt immigrant-friendly law enforcement policies. There have been campaigns to encourage states to adopt practices that provide greater access to the ballot, easier registration, more voting days, early voting, and the like. We have used People Power to bring out folks for demonstrations at the border to protest family separation, or in D.C. to protest the revocation of DACA, or for that matter, Obamacare. It's been a tremendously successful enterprise. It began with zero people, part of People Power, and today we have 550,000 people around this country in every state who have come together and taken some concrete action in defense of liberty in their local environment. And then we got involved in the midterms. And we used People Power in the midterms. One of the ways we got involved in the midterms was by supporting ballot initiatives that were pro-civil rights, pro-civil liberties, and fighting back against ballot initiatives that were anti-civil rights and anti-civil liberties. So we used our People Power volunteers and our resources that people had given us through donations to push, for example, Amendment 4 in Florida, which led to the re-enfranchisement of 1.4 million people who were denied the right to vote simply because they had had a felony conviction in their past. We supported successfully a ballot initiative in Michigan that increased access to the vote by another 250,000 people in that state. We supported a ballot initiative in Louisiana that ended the practice of allowing people to be convicted by non-unanimous juries, a practice that was adopted in Louisiana after the Civil War, when they had to allow blacks to serve on the juries. They said, okay, well, then we're no longer going to require unanimous juries. That way, if all the whites agree, we can convict, even if the black jurors don't. That remained part of Louisiana law until the 2018 midterms, when the Louisiana voters voted to get rid of it. We fought a ballot initiative in Massachusetts that would have curtailed a law that extended protection against discrimination to transgender folks. And we got involved in a lot of DA elections, not supporting candidates because we are a nonpartisan organization, but educating people about the power of prosecutors and the role prosecutors have played in the rise of mass incarceration. And in many cities across this country, people voted into office new prosecutors who came into office on a campaign to reduce incarceration, to not arrest people for marijuana, and to seek more productive responses to crime than simply locking people up and throwing away the key. And we got involved in some actual candidate, big candidate elections. So one was in Kansas, not far from here, a guy named Chris Kobach. I don't know if anyone knows that name, but Chris Kobach was the Secretary of State of Kansas. And we had sued Chris Kobach so many times over the years. He is the kind of the brainchild of the Republican strategies to suppress votes and to harass immigrants. Those are his two goals in life: suppress immigrants, harass voters, or the other way around: suppress voters, harass immigrants. And so we have sued him over many of these. In fact, the year before, in 2017. We had a trial in Kansas challenging a voter ID law, the most restrictive voter ID law in the country, that Chris Kobach had put in place as Secretary of State. And, you know, ordinarily when you sue, a state for its law and its practice, they bring in their lawyers from their Justice Department or their Attorney General's office to defend. But Chris Kobach, who, you know, was the Secretary of State, said, I don't need their help. I went to Harvard, Yale Law School. I was a Rhodes Scholar. I'll defend myself. And so he defended himself in that trial. Well, by the end of the trial, it was about a week-long trial, we had not only defeated him and had a resounding a decision from the court that his policies were illegal, but that the court had held him in contempt of court numerous times during the week of the trial for his conduct during the trial, and at the end of the trial ordered him to take remedial legal education. So then Chris Kobach decides, well, I did so well here, why don't I run for governor? And over the course of the midterms, we had tremendous engagement from people power folks who got petitions signed to put referendums on the ballot, who made phone calls to get people to vote, who knocked on doors. And so we went from 250,000 people aligning themselves and having taken some concrete measure to defend liberty before the midterms to 550,000 after. And to me, that's the source of our strength going forward. It is that we have people across this country who see themselves as defenders of liberty, just like the NRA has people across this country who see themselves as defenders of gun rights. That, at the end of the day, is where strength lies in a democracy. And you've got to build that if you're going to be effective in going forward. So I want to close with two quotes that both, I think, reflect on this. And it comes from a judge by the name of Learned Hand. He was a judge on the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York in the 40s and the 50s. He's often said to be the greatest judge never to have been appointed to the Supreme Court. He certainly had the greatest name of any judge. Learned Hand, what a name. He was invited in 1942 to this remarkable ceremony. It was a ceremony in Central Park to celebrate the naturalization, the taking of oath of immigrants to become American citizens, of over 100,000 newly naturalized citizens. They all came together, 100,000 of them, took the oath and became American citizens. I mean, think about the difference between that celebration of this country as a nation of immigrants compared to what our federal government is doing today with respect to the demonization of immigrants. But at that ceremony, they asked Learned Hand to speak, and he gave a talk called The Spirit of Liberty, and he closed that talk with a quote which I've always loved, and it's, "Liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. When it dies there, no court, no constitution, no law can save it. While it lies there, it needs no court, no constitution, no law to preserve it." Now, like many great quotes, this is an overstatement. We need courts, we need the Constitution, we need laws. They remind us of our commitments to our better selves. But it recognizes a central truth, which is that ultimately, the guardians of liberty are not the courts, they're us. They are citizens, they are you and me, they are every one of us. We can be guardians of liberty, and if we are, liberty will flourish. And if we don't, it won't. We can't rely on courts, constitution, and law. We have to engage ourselves. And then this is a quote that comes from Cornel West and Roberto Unger, a book, The Future of American Progressivism. They write in there, they say, "Hope is more the consequence of action than its cause. As the experience of the spectator favors fatalism, so the action of the agent produces hope." And what they mean by that, I think, is it's not that you're either born with a hope gene or not. It is not part of your genes. Hope doesn't lead people to act. The causal direction is in the other way. Action produces hope. And the same thing is true of inaction. The experience of the spectator favors fatalism. If you sit back and you don't go out to the airport and protest, you say, "Oh, well, nothing will change. What can I do about it?" That'll build fatalism. But if you take action, you produce hope. And so what gives me hope in this time of peril is all the people who have taken action, from the Women's March to the airport demonstrations to the town halls about Obamacare to the Parkland student movement to the Me Too movement. To all of you who are here tonight, to those who have joined the ACLU and other organizations in fighting for what this country stands for at its best and against what it stands for at its worst. Thank you.
You were just listening to David Cole on Guardians of Liberty. He spoke at Colorado College in Colorado Springs in September 2019. David Cole is the National Legal Director of the American Civil Liberties Union. He's the author of many books, including Engines of Liberty. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit organization Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Glenn Greenwald, Chris Hedges, and Naomi Klein. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.